My name is Father White here at the Pontifical Faculty, and I'm very happy to introduce Father Richard Schenck. It's rare enough that one should encounter a person who has engaged sufficiently with modern German philosophy and theology so as to be an expert in the development of modern German theology in both Catholic and Protestant spheres, or someone who is truly an expert medievalist who does critical editions of people like Robert Kilwardby and can situate problematics of 13th and 14th century theology within their original context. But to encounter someone who does both at once and interweaves the conversations of the two into an engagement with one another is impressive and extraordinarily enriching. And Father Richard Schenck, by no mere accident, has been named a Master of Sacred Theology in the Order of Preachers, which is the highest title given to those who pursue the study of theology and the teaching of it, which he shares with Archbishop De Noia, who has also awarded this title. So some of what Professor Mulcahy explored yesterday about the designation of those who should make adjudications in theological matters continues in the order in that appellation. Father Richard entered the Order of Preachers in the province of the Holy Name, California, in 1971, and was ordained a priest in 1978, and escaped from the clutches of Northern Californian paradise to go to the brooding continent of Europe and live for a very long time in Germany, where he completed a doctorate. He was a research assistant under the great Cardinal Leo Schefzik, important theologian, worked closely with a number of important philosophers and theologians, ran for a time as the director for many years, actually, of the Hanover Institute of Philosophical Research, taught also back in Berkeley in the 90s, and ran the Intercultural Forum for Studies in Faith and Culture at the John Paul II Cultural Center in the years before it was transformed by the Knights of Columbus. He has been the regent of studies of his province and was in 2011 made the president, appointed the president of the Catholic University of Eichstätt, the only Catholic university in Germany. And there he is currently still, I think for a short time, teaching as a theologian before he makes his next decision, which we all want to find out about, including, I think, himself. He's meeting with his provincial soon. And he has written a lot of interesting, fascinating articles on the shape of modern theology. He has a major work, which I won't try to read to you in German, but which I can translate, called The Grace of Perfected Finitude, on the Transcendental Theological Interpretation of Thomistic Anthropology, which is a massive, important engagement with Rahner on the shape of Catholic theology in modernity. He's also got a book on the theory of sacrifice and interdisciplinary discussion, and a book called The Continuity of the Person on Promising and Trust. And a number of his fascinating essays are currently being translated to be published in the Thomistic Resource Month series at Catholic University of America Press, hopefully in about a year from now. Anyway, the title of his talk this afternoon is The Dominican Need of and Service to the University, Untimely Meditations on Mercy and Wisdom. Please help me welcome Father Richard Schenck.
Father Thomas Joseph, thank you very much. Thanks also to Father Dominic Legge for his preparation and to the Thomistic Institute and for all of the typical and wonderful hospitality that I've experienced here. Coming back to the very first talk of our conference and its description of the office of the Master of the Sacred Palace, perhaps you'll allow me to dedicate this talk today to the memory of Georges Cottier, who died a few days ago and was buried today. His coat of arms has the motto Veritas et Misericordia, which is pretty much a short description of what I'm going to be trying to talk about. The Dominican Need of and Service to the University, Untimely Meditations on Mercy and Wisdom. I begin with a section called Apples and Oranges? The initial, if merely apparent, incongruity of the theme of our present conference can be suggested by a diachronic comparison of the changing relationships between the terms university and Dominican. Although Hastings Rashtal's Medieval Universities is no friend of the Dominicans, none of the three volumes of this classic study can tell the story of the early development of the European university without including the friars in its narrative. A recent four-volume overview of the history of the university in Europe, initiated by the European University Association and edited by Walter Ruick, without any particular animosity towards Dominicans, is able to portray the more recent history of the Western and Eastern European University without any reference to the Dominicans at all, admittedly also with but scant reference to Catholic universities or Catholic education in any form. This contrast touches on two thematic challenges to be addressed here: the memory of the greater contemporary indifference of the two intentional communities to one another, the Dominicans and the university, but also, and at first more surprising, the memory of the only gradually acquired, then partial, and ever precarious association of the two institutions with one another precisely in the high and late Middle Ages. I'm going to maintain that there's a point to all of that. The primary goal of these reflections on these two epochs is to ask about what might be learned for the Dominican Order and for the university from the memory of their more remote and more recent relationships. The following reflections intend to show that, despite the apparent incongruity, a fresh comparison of the older conversation between the two partners with what remains in recent times of greatest importance to each of them could benefit both of these institutions today. In a first step, this paper will distinguish the different speeds or paces at which the concern for mercy and then the concern for wisdom took shape and advanced to the forefront of the early Dominican interest in study and in the university. There is an abiding, if surprising, significance in the fact that the initial and foundational link between mercy and study only gradually, if inexorably, led to the qualified embrace of a sapiential and interdisciplinary sense of the university. I'll be coming back to interdisciplinary more often, and Archbishop de Noy will forgive me for that. He forgives me for so many other things, so let's add it to the list. I will argue that the not monopolistic but singularly cherished position of the legacy of Thomas Aquinas among the many theological projects fostered in the Dominican Order involves in part the congeniality of Thomas's notions of mercy and wisdom with the initial motivations and the gradual evolution of the wider order. In a second step, in the context of current debates about the university, about the idea of the university, and also about the Second Vatican Council's view of the gravissimo momentum of education, it must be asked how these two seemingly quaint and private virtues, mercy and wisdom, might speak to the secular and Catholic universities in this, our time, of their scientific, educational, cultural, political, and ecclesial crisis. So the first major section, the places and paces of mercy and wisdom in the historical development of the early Dominican interest in studies and then in the university. First subsection here, mercy and study. Now I'll come to wisdom and study in the second. Mercy and study. Looking at their formational years, the university and the Dominican order appear to have shared much in common. Especially when viewed from a certain distance, they both can be said to have originated, taken shape, and found acceptance in the high Middle Ages of Western Europe as a largely urban and mobile modification of the older orders and cathedral chapters together with their schools, establishing new forms of international communication and collegiality, supported by shifting alliances of the contemporary church, state, and society. Both institutions would take an interest in and become of interest to non-European cultures. While that general statement of a common temporal, geographical, social, and economic provenance of the university and the Dominican Order is not false, more discerning insights into early Dominican involvement in education have been provided by recent scholarship, such as Michel Mouquet's 1998 study, First the Bow is Bent in Study, which allows us to distinguish between the growing Dominican involvement in the growing reality of the university, on the one hand, and on the other hand, a more fundamental commitment of the Dominican Order to study, even prior to and outside of or alongside the university. Michel Mouquet will know that I would have mentioned her even if she hadn't been here and hadn't been quoted in every other talk until now, but all the better that I can follow up here. The talk is, in a certain way, simply a speculative and practical reflection on the historical facts that Professor Mouquet provides in her really surprising book, which knocks down quite intentionally a lot of the French legend building that we've relied on for so many years. So I want to ask, what meaning is there in this twofold pace that takes place in establishing mercy and study and then wisdom and university studies as ideals within the order? This devotion to study for religious institution, this novel and evidently central ideal of study, was present from the very beginning of the order and was deeper in its motivation and wider in its practice than its gradual expression in university studies. Closer historical research, while revealing complex developments too extensive to be recapitulated here in much detail, also allows us to distinguish between the original and foundational Dominican commitment to study, on the one hand, and on the other, the equally original, but even more fundamental concern for the apostolic task of the friars to enhance the capacity of their contemporaries for a full, vibrant, and genuine Catholic faith. The goal of mercy was in play in the Dominican approach to the university prior to the gradually unfolding goal of an interdisciplinary sense of wisdom. What these reflections will argue is that the secondary status of studies, as immediately concomitant with but not exhausting the work of mercy as the goal of the Dominican order, and the tertiary status of the university as gradually falling from but not exhausting the sense and the role of and importance of study, should not be misunderstood as a sign of their insignificance or negotiability. It can be shown that study in principle, and then university studies in particular, were no mere accidents, but rather characteristic conditions, expressions, and or consequences of the basic commitments of the Dominican charism. If the derived or founded character of these ideals explains in part why, at times of dissolution, they have been undervalued by leaders and members of the Dominican Order, the conditioned necessity of these ideals for realizing the primary goals of the Order is also a major reason to hope, in the words of Honorius III, cited at the beginning of the Dominican Constitutions, he whoever makes his church fruitful with new offspring, wanting to make these modern times measure up to former times and to propagate the Catholic faith, end quote, might inspire again today both a renewal of the apostolic, mercy-driven zeal for academic study and a determined commitment to the genuine idea of the university. If one could attempt to distinguish, as has been tried for types of Christology, between spiritualities from below and spiritualities from above, the earliest accounts given of St. Dominic place him in that first genus of saints. The prayers attributed to Dominic tend overwhelmingly to regard his approach to God and God's saints as motivated by his search for God's mercy, seeking directly the salvation of souls together with the gift of faith congruent with it, or at least for the means to pursue this same double goal, salvation and faith, by means of verbal communication together with an institution to sustain it. That's the genus. The specific difference of Dominic's charism within this genus of mercy or spirituality from below is provided by that particular suffering that moved him to turn time and time again to God, the painful inability of his contemporaries to believe aright. The aphorism which Dominic and the early Dominicans appropriated from Grandmont as an ideal, namely to speak with God or about him, receives here an implicit, at least implicit, extension, also to speak with or about human beings concerning their relationship to God in genuine faith. This became explicit in Brother Rudolph's testimony at the Bologna canonization hearings. Quote, at home or on the road, Dominic always wanted to speak of God or of human salvation. The earliest texts about Dominic and his foundation, as well as the earliest self-articulations of his foundation or the authoritative, especially papal confirmations of his order, refer repeatedly to this sense of mercy as the basis for his labors for the salvation of souls associated closely with their free assent to a full and genuine faith. The significance for the thematic of mercy is threefold. First, the very frequency with which Dominic's compassion about defective faith is mentioned underscores the centrality of this motive for him and his foundation. Secondly, the texts testify not just to the fact, but also to the particular quality of mercy, envisioned here amidst the many possible divergent readings of what mercy might mean. Recent years have seen a diversification of notions of mercy, nearly to the point of equivocation. Thomas Aquinas' somewhat later conception of mercy, running from his sentence commentary to the Summa Theologiae, shows him, so to speak, a third-generation Dominican, in line with the particular sense of mercy evidenced in earlier Dominican writings, when he develops the thought of Augustine to describe mercy as considering the suffering of another as one's own, and implicitly in hope for its being able to be overcome. In contrast to some recent treatments, it would seem from Thomas's perspective impossible for God and detrimental to divine and human mercy to declare mercy the defining attribute of God, the Grundattribut, as one cardinal recently wrote. If mercy implies the relationship to the suffering other, and if God's freedom to create and redeem the other and the hope which God's mercy, precisely as a free gift, provides the world, are both to be saved, and finally, if both freedom and hope are prerequisites of genuine human mercy, then it is corrosive of mercy to present it as synonymous with that goodness which already in its imminently Trinitarian reality is diffusivum sui. In other words, as William of Auxerre especially made the middle point of his theology, the fact that God's goodness, God is goodness, but that this goodness in the Trinity already is diffusivum sui, means that God did not need to create the world, and therefore also that God's chief attribute cannot be mercy. But that's a reason for having a certain hope for the world, because God didn't need to create the world, and the fact that he did with foreknowledge means that the world is quite unlikely to be, as they say, headed to hell in a basket. God's relationship to his own goodness is the basis of his merciful relationship to others and a privileged motivation for that hope for the world which is needed for human mercy as well. I'm going to try and show you briefly that without hope you wouldn't have human mercy. So it's not just about God, it's about us. The primacy of the good before the merciful is necessary precisely for appreciating and imitating divine mercy. This sense of divine mercy, like human mercy, aims at the overcoming of the causes of suffering, at restoring the good, the lack or loss of which had been the most obvious occasion for mercy. Thomas Aquinas tells us the two chief obstacles to human mercy, the inability to imagine any weakness in oneself, or conversely, the inability to imagine any hope for oneself, both of these bad relationships to oneself hinder the relationship of mercy to the others. So the inability to imagine one's own faults, and therefore not being able to carry the faults as one's own, or the inability to imagine hope for oneself, and therefore the inability to carry suffering of another towards hope, towards overcoming the suffering. These two inabilities already speak to a third significant moment of mercy, the desire for the comprehensive restoration of the good. It is a mercy that hopes for a greater good than what can be provided by mere clemency. Clemency is a subsection of mercy, but not the whole of mercy. Where clemency alleviates the suffering of externally added punishment, mercy in the fuller sense seeks to eliminate comprehensively the suffering of another considered as if it were one's own. To seek clemency without the mercy of a comprehensive healing is to seek the dimidia venia of merely forensic justification, dimidia venia, halfway pardon. Impium esperare a Deo dimidiam via veniam, although it would be directly impious to hope from God only halfway forgiveness. To propagate nothing more than the mere forbearance of a suffering, perhaps in order to deny the series of one's own deficiencies or of one's own hopes as well, corresponding to those two hindrances to genuine mercy, implies at best a desire for the dimidia venia of clemency, but not for the fullness of mercy. To consider that form of suffering as somehow our own, which is the inability to believe aright, is an intentionality that demands not merely our acknowledgement of the manifold frequency of disbelief, much less our own frequent accommodations to it, but also demands study, our study, of what weakens and what can confirm both our own faith and that of others. The primacy of the sense of mercy, which aims at the revitalization of genuine faith, demands this quality of study of those who are moved by compassion to the apostolic service of the gospel. The constitutions of 1220, by which the initial experiences with the customary of 1216 were sorted and formalized, sums up the association of study pursued, as it says, with the greatest industry of the particular work of mercy for which the order was designed. Quote, our order is recognized as having been especially instituted from the beginning for preaching and the salvation of souls, and our study should be principally and ardently directed to this end with greatest industry so that we can be useful to the souls of our neighbors. So study became one of the three major points in those early constitutions. If the Second Vatican Council was right to suggest that the renovatio comodata of religious life demands a certain retrieval of the founder's charism, then it is not improbable to suggest that this historical link of mercy and study continues to pinpoint a necessary condition for any serious renewal of the Dominican vocation today. Dominic and his community embraced this sense of merciful study from the very beginning of their movement. The genuinely novel expressions of the existential centrality of study in their common life and apostolic program have been traced well by recent historical studies. The promise of helping to realize the plans of Lateran IV for schools of the faith in each diocese had already been reflected in the language of Bishop Falk's commission of 1215, that the friars were to teach the rule of faith. The opening of conventual schools, priory schools, and to non-friars was a further step in this direction, one which required not just the preparation of the few, but the ongoing involvement of all. Fittingly, the tithes provided by Bishop Falk were used in good part for the acquisition of needed books. The importance of establishing libraries, even if by copying the books needed, was reflected in the customs adopted already in 1216, which foresaw structures of dispensations and penalties meant to foster studies. The daily chapter of faults for slackness in teaching, studying, or developing the library made study a focus of religious concern. The enrollment of all the friars, including Dominic, in the theology classes of Master Alexander Stavensby at the Cathedral School in Toulouse, of greater consequence still, the employment of John of St. Albans in the convent in Paris, signaled this general commitment. It was reflected as well in the architecture of the priories, beginning already with the new priory in Toulouse, which would include not only a library, but individual cells that the student master, himself something of a tutor, would assign only to those who were and remained especially involved in studies. It's Father Andrew Hofer here. Just imagine the power of being able to say, you're studying well, you have a private room, you're not studying so well, back into the dormitory. It was a great, great motivator. Adaptions of academic innovations like daily and weekly repetitions of lectures and disputations were developed as communal practices. The first constitutions of 1220 were devoted not just to questions of governance and preaching, but to study. The so-called dispersion of the brethren in August of 1217, especially to the University of Paris, to Madrid, and to the University of Bologna, at least soon, but at least in concept and intent, each newly founded convent was to maintain a conventual center of studies. The admonitions for the statutes of 1259, which I myself value much more than Michel Mocquet does. Anyway, the admonitions of these statutes of 1259 showed that this ideal had not always been met and called for priories without active lectors to be phased out. Very nicely put, if they can't support a school, we understand that, but no young brothers and no brothers at all should be sent there in the future. Also basically, get a school or get a new priory. As much as the admonitions of 1259 reflected much of what had been common practice since 1216 for the conventual scholae, as well as in the so-called distributed university that they formed together with provincial and general studia that had developed since then, there was one point in which they also recommended an innovation that was still a matter of controversy, experiment, and compromise, so not such an old tradition. Quote, according to these statutes of 1259, that provision be made in provinces lacking a house of studies, that there be a house of studies in those provinces that don't have a house of theological studies, that there be at least a house of studies for liberal arts and philosophy where the young Dominicans might be instructed. With this endorsement of an institutional innovation most extensively practiced until then in the Provence, namely the foundation of provincial centers of study for philosophy and the sciences, the commission of five friars acting, as it seems, at the suggestion of the master, Humbertus Romanus, signaled their acceptance of a disputed departure from the early prohibition of Dominican study, of non-theological topics from Dominican study. That prohibition of non-theological topics had mirrored a common attitude at the universities of the time toward the introduction of Aristotelian notions of philosophy and the sciences into a close conversation with theology, and the universities themselves had experienced in the course of the 13th century the controversial but steady expansion of the discourse between non-theological and theological disciplines. Of the five friars who had been recruited to author the admonitions at Valenciennes in 1259, Albertus Magnus was easily the best versed and most vociferous proponent of the range of sciences that could be developed along roughly Aristotelian lines. He was that rarest of scholars who not merely made room for the practice of non-theological disciplines by others, but could himself embody the innovative scholarship in the sciences. Many of the philosophical schools and programs developed in the provinces had by contrast restricted their own pursuits in philosophy largely to logic, even as the wider canon of Aristotelian learning, with all the concomitant challenges to conventional notions of the Christian faith, had gained notoriety among the Latins. Even a Robert Kilwardby, who had entered the order after a much respected magisterium in logic at Paris, wrote his De Orto Scientiarum around 1250, soon after his entry into the Dominican order and prior to his completion of theological studies, in the years when the wider order was still hoping that the Oxford Dominicans would readily comply with the mandate to open a Studium Generale, which they didn't do until after 1260. Written at the request of Kilwardby's new confreres in Oxford, the work defends a notion of philosophy and the sciences that goes well beyond the disciplines of logic and rhetoric. as would become especially apparent in 1277 with his criticisms of Thomas Aquinas's anthropology and its Aristotelian background, Kirby's skepsis about the impact of newer Aristotelian learning on matters of faith would deepen over the next 25 years. He was not alone, even outside of England, as Gerard de Fachet would also show with his critique of philosophical pursuits in the Vitae Fratrum from the year after the admonition of Valenciennes. You can see the dispute, one for philosophy, the other very much against it. This critique could refer to the constitutions of 1220, which had forbidden friars to engage themselves largely with philosophy and pagan literature, or with the secular sciences and so-called liberal arts, making room for dispensation, but as a rule, discouraging this kind of study. Some of the most influential Dominican masters of the second generation would, however, bring their previous education in the arts into the order. So, for example, Roland of Cremona, who sought to balance the primacy of theology, which he defended, with a certain training in philosophy and with his own field of medicine. The masters of the order, John of Wildeshausen and especially Humbert of Romans, would make increasingly, if still cautious, use of dispensations from these prohibitions to allow for some broader institutionalized study of philosophy and the sciences within the order, as well as exceptional cases of specialization, all still set in subordinate relation to the basic goal of merciful service to souls. The hesitancy of the Dominicans to institutionalize the study of philosophy and secular sciences is behind the suggestion by Rachtel's medieval universities that the general requirement of the 1250s at Paris and Oxford, that the theological masters would need in the future to have taught previously as arts masters, had the intention of restricting the number of new mendicant masters of theology. The systematic centerpiece of Dominican studies from the university faculties back down to the conventual scholae was Peter Lombard's sentences. While it was not unheard of for non-Dominicans, for example, the Franciscans Oddo Rigaldi or also Roger Bacon, to begin their commentaries on the sentences with explicit references to the wisdom sought in systematic theology, the Dominican professors of the period show a characteristic tendency to summarize their systematic hopes under the title of wisdom. Sapientia is found among the opening words of the sentence commentaries of Richard Fishacre, Albert the Great, Thomas Aquinas, Robert Kilwiby, Ulrich of Strasbourg, Bombolognos de Bononia, and also Hannibaldus de Hannibaldis. Some of those names sound like they're right out of Tolkien, but they're ours. The concept of wisdom in the 13th century, these concepts were no less divergent than the concept of mercy is in our own. Richard Scheffler noted the differing senses of wisdom, that they can be distinguished from one another by the degree of space they allow or deny to sapientia in its relation to scientia and pietas. That was in that first Festschrift for Joseph Ratzinger in 1987. As in his discussion of mercy, Thomas Aquinas' description of wisdom in theology itself, but also in philosophy and as a gift of the Holy Spirit. This description of wisdom corresponds to and helped also to shape the institutional development of the overall strategy of Dominican studies. The interconnection and yet distinction of the objects and methods of the sciences, and in particular of philosophical subdisciplines, prevent their being determined by or fully divorced from the study of theology. Theology brings to the exclusively experiential sciences perspectives and possibilities that otherwise are too easily overlooked. We heard about some of them yesterday. Wisdom in this sense allows the ordering of, not the substitution of faith, for experiential sciences and conversely ensures for the reflection on faith the enrichment by, but not the reduction to, positive sciences and philosophy. Despite the misleading characterization of this relationship as harmony, the relationship of theology to the other university disciplines will, like other important relationships, be tested at times by less than harmonious phases. The theological debates around the antinomy of any experiential answer to the question of the eternity or non-eternity of the world, prominent during Thomas's second Parisian regency, in the Parisian censures of 1270 and 1277, in the Correctory's controversy, that all helps to define the Thomistic sense of the relationship of philosophy and theology, or if you like, of experience and faith. Against the positions both of a John Peckham, who would seek to draw philosophical certainty from faith, or a Boethius of Dacia, who would oppose the answers of faith and philosophical certainty, Thomas would argue for the quality, importance, and unique message of faith as set in the midst of an abiding experiential uncertainty. This controverted position showed paradigmatically Thomas's sense of theological wisdom and the importance of the dialogue of studied and argumentative science of faith with largely autonomous disciplines of experiential reason. The openness of theological wisdom, not just to experiential sciences, but to the donum sapientiae, provided Thomas an additional link back to the sense of mercy behind all Dominican study. It makes all the more attentive, this sort of wisdom makes all the more attentive to the regulae contingentium quae humanis actibus subsum, to the rules of the contingent factors that underlie human acts, to truths still but poorly realized in social reality. In the terms defined by the Second Vatican Council, theology in this sense allows us to see more clearly not just the joys and hopes, but also the fears and tears of our age, even as they come into the church, to resist the temptation to postulate uncritically our present societal facticity as normative or perhaps even as revelatory, but rather to be empowered for the merciful task and the duty of scrutinizing the signs of the times and of interpreting them in the light of the gospel. This Thomistic sense of wisdom corresponds to Gaudium et Spes IV, to scrutinize the signs of the times in the light of the gospel, and not, as some interpretations of the council have put it, to interpret the gospel in the light of the signs of the times. Wisdom as a pattern of the Dominican interest in the university extended, expressed, and recapitulated mercy as a motif identifiable in the Dominican sense of study in general. It is here that the abiding significance of the early Dominican insistence on the special task of theology with the church, academy, and society, a task to which they regarded themselves together with others as particularly called, should be sought, and it is here that the possible contribution of the early Dominican sense of merciful and sapiential study can still be of service to today's university. With that, I come to the second and shorter section, the needs of the secular and Catholic university today. The multiple, and I'll reverse the order. With the Dominican, early Dominican development, I did first mercy and then wisdom. Here I'll take first wisdom and then come to mercy. The multiplication and development of universities in and then beyond medieval Europe is part of a remarkable and ongoing story. But with such expansion also comes the danger of commoditization, and so the urgent task of self-examination and the search for, forgive the use here of an inflationary term that I usually avoid, excellence, the realization of which is often found in inverse proportion to the frequency of the term's appearance in mission statements and visitation manuals. Having become a key factor of society, the university reflects, happily or not, both perhaps, its given context in the history of the wider culture, here notably in the dynamics of secularity and its crises. In the last 15 years or so, Catholic reflection on the university has brought to this common task of self-review an uncommon, even unlikely resource, the meteoric moment, or the Sternstunde in the sense of Stefan Zweig, of John Henry Newman's 9 discourses from 1852 on the idea of the university. In a series of essays, Alistair MacIntyre drew attention to the present-day importance of these discourses, and he has been joined and nuanced by theologians such as Reinhard Hüther, Francesca Murphy, and Gavin DaCosta, as well as by John Garvey, president of the Catholic University of America. The four interrelated chief constituents of Newman's idea of a university that this discussion has retrieved for the ongoing reform of today's universities could all be enhanced by recalling the early Dominican sense of academic wisdom and compassion. And I see Newman's idea in 4 points. The idea of the university demands discourse among the disciplines about common fields of inquiry, and that includes theological inquiry. A genuine university discourse will relate in non-reductive fashion faith, reason, history, and contemporary experience. What is useful to souls is more than just pragmatic utility. And finally, teaching, research, and communication beyond the academy should not be isolated from or allowed to dominate one another, teaching, research, and publication. In the context of these present reflections, only a few remarks are possible for each of these 4 constituent elements of the university idea grouped together here in pairs. So I'll address Newman's points first in the first 2 and then in the second 2. The first 2 relate, if you like, to wisdom, the wisdom of interdisciplinarity and the proprium of theology, to points 1 and 2 in Newman. The idea of the university demands universal discourse among the disciplines about common fields of inquiry, their material objects, if you like, including the themes developed by theology. This is arguably a short formula for Newman's working definition of the university as a place of universal learning, the first sentence in the work. The formal exclusion of theology from the curriculum or from interdisciplinary discussion, but also the replacement of theology, even at a nominally Catholic university, by philosophies and sciences of culture and religion, eliminates the necessary condition of genuine university conversation. Those modal questions about humanity, which cannot be answered by an appeal to societal facticity, which proves less revelatory than perhaps many a bishop or theologian or ecclesial functionary might hope, namely the question of what I and we can and cannot know, what I and we should and should not do, what I and we may and may not hope for and or mourn for. These are questions in which a theology which deserves that name and articulated into the full range of its theological subdisciplines has much to add and also much to learn from the wider scientific conversation of disciplines, then drawing from and receiving them by its own methods. The reflection on just these methods, just think, for example, of the history of the term hermeneutics, the reflection on just these methods in theology is an obvious example of such a dialogue. The search for corresponding structures within the university, or where such conviviality is precluded, at specialized institutions, like this one, complementary to them, can be encouraged by the retrieval of the memory of the gradual and qualified opening of Dominican theology to philosophy and the arts, most notably by the Thomistic distance both to fideism and rationalism, so to Peckham and to Boethius of Dacian, especially to the epistemologically most optimistic and most pessimistic forms of each. There's obviously a fideism which says we're going to learn a lot about the world if we believe, and there's fideism says we'll never know a lot about the world, so let's just believe, so optimistic and pessimistic. And the same with rationalism. There are rationalisms that say we can know almost nothing, and there are rationalisms that say, with Hegel, we can know almost everything. Thomas excludes fideism and rationalism in both of these types of developments. Newman's sense of the university demands ongoing development, in particular in the form of an assimilation of the other without a loss of self. So that on wisdom and Newman's first 2 notes of a university, now on mercy and the second 2 notes of a university. Mercy, non-utilitarian utility, and the communities beyond the university, ad tertium et quartum. Newman's arguments for a genuinely liberal education have been translated into today's context by contemporary readers suspicious of the technological instrumentalization of today's research universities. University learning is more than a design laboratory for marketable commodities and military weaponry, or for the training of as a training center for future workers for industrial, pedagogical, social, or even ecclesiastical services. For that very reason, the Dominican sense of mercy and of what is useful to souls might arouse the suspicion of an age suffering under the particular dysfunctionality which universal functionalism produces. Calls for ecology, including human ecology, point to the growing evidence of the contraproductive results of that strange blend of pragmatism and hedonism which masquerades as a free society for those on the sunny side of the street, or as a world in the church, in the church in the world of today, where world is simply reduced to a very special class of bobos, for lack of a better word. Utilitarianism is not a useful way to distinguish or rejoin the means and ends of Augustine's uti frui distinction. Dominican preaching began in some of the more prosperous areas of Europe by addressing those who feared that, despite all their new wealth, life on earth was futile, even evil. In terms of today's university discourse, especially in cultures where nihilism and prosperity have not yet proven to be mutually exclusive, the study of economics cannot be reduced to private or corporate business administration. The study of law should be more than the neo-sophistic practice of how to win cases or control public policy. The study of medicine should not be equally open to the restoration of health and the termination of life. And history cannot consist chiefly in the application of statistical sociology to past, much less to present times. Likewise, the study of theology is meant as more than training for future church ministers. Ministers trained in this way would be ill-prepared for their ministry. Human aspirations exceed the fruits of human organization, and the most humane ministers and the most effective organizations help them to take stock of this fact. Inquiry into the question that humanity hopefully becomes to itself can also be of eminent use to immediately practical pursuits, helping to resist the progressive slide of whole cultures into dysfunctionality and destructiveness. The questions about the usefulness of studies raise also the question as well for whom the university is meant to be useful. The medieval Universitas Magistrorum et Scholarium was supported usually by church, state, and societal forces, each in their own partially overlapping interests. The intense discussion among readers of Newman about the relative weight of teaching and research is perhaps less important in this essay than the undoubted relation of university studies to the public's of church, academy, and society outside the university. Dominican study and its Thomistic expression have stood at times in the service of excessively uniform expectations for these three publics. The pendulum, however, has long since swung in the opposite direction. The debate about the ecclesial vocation of the theologian is qualified by the sense of church that is presupposed. In Germany, for example, the State Commission for the Management of German University Studies, the so-called Wissenschaftsrat, or Council of Science and Humanities, recommends at present a double strategy to encourage the transformation of confessional-based theology into cultural and religious studies with as little ecclesial self-determination as possible, and, in a shift from the debates of the 1970s that questioned the right of theology to be present at state universities, to encourage that the training of all future ministers occur preferably at just such state-sponsored centers of religious studies so as to minimize confessional diversity in the future. I can read you the quote afterwards. It's quite frightening. Religious studies at the university should be structured to serve forms of ecclesial identity more thoroughly accommodated to the wider society, so the hope of this Council of Science and Humanities, embraced by many a higher cleric. In the United States, too, in a shift away from the forms of comparative religious studies common there during the last 50 years, there have been newer attempts to make religious studies provide capacities for compassionate leadership in a post-confessional society, presupposing studies that have moved past the knowledge piece. I have this from a wonderful article in the New York Times a few days ago about an institution out of Claremont. I don't think it has the approval of the Claremont colleges, but it has taken its name. So they want now to be to offer expertise online for developing capacities for compassionate leadership, but having moved beyond the knowledge piece. The likely outcome of religious studies purified of both faith and history seems less compassionate than the language suggests, creating rather what, following Marc Auger, we might call a religious non-place, or freely put in the terms of Robert Musil, a spirituality ohne Eigenschaften, a spirituality without qualities, without the kind of identity that requires a more singular focus. Sharing the luctus et angor of contemporary society, highlighted by McIntyre's analysis of its characteristic blend of the manager, the therapist, and the rich estate, such an assimilated ecclesial community built on studies of this kind would also likely be one organized by managers who design the training of therapist ministers who then in turn have the task of assuaging the consciousnesses of the rich estates in their communities. It is here that the alternative form of compassion suggested by the Dominican Association of Mercy and Studies might be of help both to ecclesial and university discourse. If compassionate attention to the sufferings of others requires the flourishing of self, with insights into one's own failings and into one's own firm hope of overcoming them, then a Christian theology understood as understanding the other and situated by a singular set of traditions might prove to be more compassionate than the kind of globalized world ethic that would deny the singularity of others and prod them to reassert it violently so as to resist their reduction to what Marc Auger would call the non-lieu of every place. The ability to acknowledge the distinction of self and others is the condition of the possibility of a free, hopeful, merciful, and sapiential bearing of their sufferings as one's own. So summed up in three theses, this paper has attempted to show the following. Precisely because of the originary great power of mercy, there are good reasons to guard against its inflationary use for mercy's sake and for the intrinsic and extrinsic goals of the university. Number two, there will be no revival of the Dominican practice of mercy without a revival of the ideals of Dominican study, including its sapiential and university traditions. And finally, although the dialogue of theology with philosophy and the humane or natural sciences can be lost by reducing theology to just another experiential discipline among others, theology as the philosophy, sociology, or history of religions, genuine theology in dialogue with philosophy and the sciences is a constituent element of the genuine university that today needs the external support of truly Catholic universities and university-level institutions like this one, hopefully including also other Dominican ones, in order to realize its potential. Many thanks.
We have some time for questions.
Thank you, Father Richard, for a great paper. Could you comment on the development? So you talked about Newman and the university, but I was thinking also of Newman on conscience and the questions of integrating this Dominican emphasis on wisdom and therefore mercy, wisdom which implies that there's a kind of ordering of our lives and that we need to somehow figure out how to order our lives to God. Voluntarily, and the movement to assuage the consciences of people, maybe not to make too many demands or to deal with misinformed consciences or something like that.
Well, I think it's an important point that calls us to think about consciences. And I would try and interpret Newman, if you like, from what Ricoeur said at the end of Oneself as Another in 1990. He takes conscience as one of those examples of attestation of something that is relatively other than simply subjectivity. You know, all of his examples of attestation come from another which is part of myself and yet other than myself, not what I really want it to be. So relating also to a body that doesn't always do what I would like and doesn't live forever, relating to other persons who have claims upon me, whether I like it or not, and the conscience, but only insofar as it's not identical with my immediate subjectivity or what I might like, or even with good intentions. Insofar as the conscience can be, even though coming from me, the voice of another than my immediate subjectivity, it is in fact a very important instant of witness. And therefore we can't encourage an idea of the conscience which would simply be a kind of approval of present day, of the present subjectivity, and has to be something with which that subjectivity can check itself and relate to that relative other which the conscience is calling it to be. And so if it's a genuine sense of conscience, one in which mercy and truth come together, then it's also merciful for the person who is trying to follow his conscience. It is then a light and something that one can grow by relating to another. It overcomes a kind of autism that a self-affirming conscience, which is no conscience at all, my conscience won't let me do anything. That would not be very merciful to me.
Thank you very much, Father Richard. I have a question perhaps about methodology of the communication of wisdom and mercy in today's environment. So I don't mean this to be a totally practical question. It's more speculative, too, about just the possibility of communication. So if nowadays we're in, let's say, a certain postmodern fragmentization of wisdom, if the university itself has become a certain mass-produced commodity, where education is proposed almost on a kind of business model in many respects, you have that reality, but then for mercy and wisdom, those are very personal dynamics. So for instance, with mercy, I would have loved, I'm sure we could talk about it further, I love the distinction between mercy and clemency, but part of the thing with mercy is it's a personal, as you describe it, it's my person being able to, in a sense, share in the personhood of someone else and lead them ultimately to the three-person God. Or let's say for wisdom, it's being in contact with someone who has wisdom, who's able to share that with me. How nowadays, given the reality of the university and this kind of mass-produced large-scale model that obtains in most places, how do we as Dominicans or just persons of goodwill reappropriate this possibility for personal wisdom and mercy?
Well, I don't think that we should start, you know, printing T-shirts that say wisdom or mercy. You know, entering into a dialogue with a university, even a Catholic university, I wouldn't use the language of mercy and wisdom. If you want to understand the Dominican development, I think we need to look at those particular termini because, they are the words that one used to articulate what we're talking about. But the substance of what we're talking about does make a lot of sense, and you can bring that into the university. I think you can make it clear why specialization is necessary, but fragmentation would take that to a level of dysfunctionality. And so to cultivate kind of dialogue across the university, including the voice of faith and the voice of theology, I think you can make a case for that in many places, not in all, unfortunately. But I think that's what you need that's what you need to argue about. Not, of course, the term wisdom. And just think of Husserl's famous essay in 1911 against Dilthey, where he just has this long polemic against wisdom. And I think it's, I wouldn't suggest we go to the wall for defending the word in public discourse. But I think that dimension of wisdom, which is interdisciplinarity, which is sapientis est ordinari, that we do see the importance of relating the disciplines to one another, I think that is crucial. And the importance of there being the voice of a genuine faith and not simply structures of religiosity and so on. I think that is; those are two very important gifts that we could, in fact, convince a large part of the university community, the academy, to accept. And at some places it won't be possible. Some places it's forbidden by law. There are some very good reasons in America for the separation of church and state. And so at certain state universities, and other than unlike Germany, there is not the possibility here of having theology. It's okay. We can live with that and make institutions that are in conversation with the university, and in that sense, still bring that dimension to the university. So those are the methods I would use.
Thank you, Father. Piggybacking on that question, I wanted to address, I have your second thesis down, written at high speed, Mercy Needs Study. Hope you won't mind being truncated that way. But my question is, could you sketch out a little bit the relationship between the specialized study of theologians and what their service is to the faithful of the church at large? Because while I was sitting here listening to you, I was thinking at the moment of my father, who has no theological training, but is currently taking a course in the catechism, and he sometimes expresses a kind of frustration. He says, oh, you know, you got your MA, you think you're so smart, and I'm not. But he says, why, at a time when the church, its laity are very, very confused, having, you know, gone through the university as a, commodity, as was expressed, the laity don't have a very nuanced understanding of the faith, probably couldn't even give you a good definition of God. At that time, what is the relationship, what is the service of specialized study, especially among Dominicans, to the lay faithful of the church? Like, is it a trickle-down? How does specialized study serve the common laity in the pew? That's my question.
Okay. Of course, it's a question of what the so-called common laity. The common laity is a very diverse group, first of all. But let me begin negatively. It's clearer. There are proposals at the only Catholic university in Germany to replace theology by simply positive sciences, by a kind of science of religion, and by pedagogical training for future ministers. So there's this idea that all we need is to let the sciences do their work, and then we train our people for the parishes, as it said, you know. What they are missing is that, in fact, the web goes much deeper than what you can simply sell at the local parish. What you need, eventually, you're going to lose that local parish because they're not just in that parish. They belong, of course, in different degrees and different persons to other communities. It's not as if they're trapped in a parish and you get to kind of control them. They belong to very many communities. And, in fact, if you can't see the web of the interrelationship between belief and its challenge, being challenged in today's world, then you're not going to be able to help them in. I doubt that your father is spending his time reading Voltaire. But if you can't address the issues around still the Enlightenment and its crisis in the present day, and its forebears going back, way back to pre-Christian times, then I don't think you're going to be able in the end to give a plausible celebration of the faith, which is, of course, also, let me put it in a shorter way, I wouldn't like to have a parish priest who didn't know about the Trinity.
Thank you, Father. So you talked about the problems of sort of instrumentalization of modern universities, and then a little bit about the medieval emphasis on how Dominicans are useful, and that's an interesting term to me, and kind of touching. But I also don't. I feel like I'm alienated from that vocabulary. So,
wait, which one?
The medieval use of
use. I mean, it could be shocking not just to you but to many others if we say we're studying to be useful, because it sounds like, okay, well, we don't really care about God. We just want a nice trick to be able to market our product. And that can't be. That's just cutting too short. It undersells what is a soul, first of all. A soul is not just someone who wants a little quick answer, and then you can manipulate them forever. That's sort of the dream of the manager bishop to supply the therapist to deal with. A soul is, you know, capable of God. It's Kapax Dei, is in a certain sense also all things. And if you want to minister to souls, you can't go out there simply with a sort of little, you know, 6-week preparation about how to convince them and, 10 Bible quotes and what kind of clothes to wear. You know, you've got to be able to yourself have seen the pain of others and made it your own. Fight your own fight to believe. I mean, you've got to believe yourself. And to do that, you've got to become a question to yourself and find the answers in this tradition. And that's what you offer then to others. So I'm just saying that it's in all of the early documents and it makes good sense. Our study is for to be useful to souls, but that use should not be seen in a utilitarian way. Another way to put it is, let's say you're regent. And the brothers come to you and say, you know, we're involved in the dialogue of sciences, and I think I really should go learn scuba diving for the next 3 years, because then I'll get to know the oceans. And that would be a nice kind of way to complement your sort of narrow theology. So send me scuba diving for 3 years. And you say, well, I'd love to, brother, whatever, but, you know, we have a limited budget, and frankly, there is a kind of hierarchy of what's important. That's what I think one of the systematic points of Michel Mouquet's books could be, if you think about it. I mean, because the Dominicans were a little bit hesitant to get involved in these non-theological projects, and then they did because they saw they needed to. I think that's the right mix. I think in a certain sense, as much as really is helpful for the overall mission of the order, believing in God and helping other people believe in God.
So do you think that it sounds like you're saying as philosophers, specifically, Dominicans can be useful in sort of untangling the souls that they're given to shepherd. Do you think that is a development, or do you think that's original? Because that seems
that's
a subtle understanding of usefulness.
That is original. What came slowly and with a certain amount of resistance was the degree to which university studies would play a role in doing that. But you know, the Dominicans were dealing with a very sophisticated group of people. I mean, the Albigensian movement, and it wasn't just that. Then there were other movements. The whole reception of Aristotle; those were very sophisticated positions, and you couldn't just kind of the Dominicans pushed back a kind of charismatic preaching that Professor Mouquet's colleague Augustine Thompson wrote about as the. In the year of the great hallelujah. If you want to see what an option was that we didn't take in the end, you can read about that.
I think this will be the last question.
Thank you. When one studies ancient history or biblical studies, when one studies ancient history or biblical studies, there's a whole slew of ancillary disciplines that the graduate students expected to learn something about or to master in part so as to do his main field of study adequately and professionally. I've noted that philosophy is often cited as that propedeutic for theology. But on the other hand, you have the wisdom as the overarching architectonic de fide presentation, the participation in divine knowledge that even the person on the street who has Christian faith possesses. In terms of professional ministry, there's a certain level of sophistication and fluency in discourse that's required to carry out that mission faithfully to others. For the non-theologian outside the university, can one, in the present scheme of things, hope to acquire such facility or competence, for lack of a better word, in theological disciplines?
I'm not exactly sure. Your question raises important points, and I would be sympathetic to most of them, except I don't know necessarily where in the details your question is what you're looking for. Obviously, I mean, I think one of the questions that is an abiding question that was dealt with in a wonderful publication that the Thomist made as a Sonderdruck, as a special little off-print from Father Munitz on theology as a potential whole. He talks about how theology is not just one discipline, but it has many sub-disciplines. And these sub-disciplines belong to the whole. But what theology is in these sub-disciplines to different degrees. And that is a very long discussion that I couldn't just answer quickly. But I'd say the measuring rod is, to what degree is that useful to the salvation of souls? To what degree is that important? To what degree does it respond to our sense of mercy, that there's a deep suffering out there which we ourselves share, and that is the inability today to believe aright? So I certainly wouldn't want to compete with Stephen Ryan and start learning all the languages he knows. And I would want all of the Dominicans to know, you know, something about the history of philosophy. So I think it's more intricate, and if you like, or more intimate to theology, even though it's an external discipline. I think it's important that all Dominicans know some philosophy. I don't think it's necessarily important that all Dominicans know ancient Akkadian, though I'm happy that some do.
Father Schenk will be denied his stipend for this talk, no doubt, because of the trouble he will have caused when all the student brothers and some of the professors go and ask for a sabbatical year to study scuba diving. But despite having planted that very tempting idea in the minds of some of us, that was a fantastic presentation. Please help me thank Professor Richard Schenk.